feelings come from many different, there's lots of different ways to generate feeling. And that song immediately has a menace to it and an ache that I just loved. And it brings in Nina Simone and it chops up Nina Simone, which is kind of vulgar and wrong. I mean, you cannot be messing with Nina Simone. And he does. And it's kind of offensive and it's kind of wrong. And I love all of the ways in which that song is wrong.
This is Essential Tremors.
I'm Lee Gardner.
I'm Matt Byers. The idea behind this show is to have musicians and other creators talk about songs that shaped who they are. We're not looking for favorite songs, necessarily. We're also not looking for songs that they'd choose to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. What we're looking for are songs that have significance to them. Songs that might have changed the course of their creative lives, or their lives in general. Chad Clark is the front person, singer, and guitarist for DC-based band Beauty Pill. Chad has a long history in the DC punk scene, going back to the early 90s when he led Discord band Smart Went Crazy, and his work in a production and mastering capacity on many records on the Discord label, as well as records such as the critically and commercially acclaimed Dismemberment Plan's breakout record Emergency and I. An extremely talented mixer and engineer, Chad's work both as an aider and a better to others, as well as in his own work, has been an important part of the DC scene and has reached audiences around the world. The first song Clark chose as being essential to him was Night Game by Paul Simon.
First song I selected is a Paul Simon song. It's called Night Game. It came out in 1976 on the album Still Crazy After All These Years. Still Crazy After All These Years is famous. It was like a huge hit record. It's mostly famous for having the single 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, which is kind of a cheesy song, I think, but I love Night Game a lot. Here's the thing. If you listen to the song, I remember as a kid believing this song was nonfiction, because this song describes a pitcher who dies on the field in the middle of a actual baseball game. And I remember thinking it was a real story, like it was, because it has such a mournful, heavy quality. The music has this mournful, really heavy, melancholic feeling that seemed completely authentic to me. And I thought it was just Paul Simon doing a very poetic telling of a sad actual thing that happened. And I remember I told my dad about it. And my dad disabused me. He's like, that never happened. There's no, he's, you know, this is before the internet, but he was like, that's a made up story. That's not real. And it blew my mind. My dad knew more about baseball than I did. It blew my mind that Paul Simon was able to summon this really deep, authentic feeling out of something that he just simply imagined. So I guess that's why this song, in a lot of ways, was instructive for me in terms of the power of imagination and how authentic doesn't necessarily fiction can be as authentic as nonfiction. And that, for me as a creative person, it was a very liberating idea. So that's why I choose Night Game.
How old were you when you heard it?
I don't know, maybe... I think I heard it in, I don't know, probably 10 or 11, maybe.
And it was a record or on the radio or probably?
Yeah, it was a record. Actually, my mom used to work for CBS Records, and we used to get these. This was not, I mean, I don't even think CBS Records still exists, but we used to get free records at home, and I listened to those at home. Yeah.
And that one song just really grabbed you.
It's a haunting song. I mean, in the middle of the song, the chords just like swoon and go into this, this really like, ethereal, beautiful place in the bridge, where he's like, the stars were white as bones. It was very chill. It's a chilling song. Because you don't even know what the song's position is, if it's simply reporting a thing that happened that's sad, or if there's some expression of connection to this person, or you don't even know why the song exists. So yeah, I love that. It's a pretty dark one, and I think there's a little bit of influence for me on my songwriting. In that he builds a picture out of pretty subtle chord differences. The chords are pretty rich, and he chooses an occasional note in the upper register that changes the angle of the music, and it's pretty subtle stuff. Subtlety is something that's not really rewarded or not as readily rewarded in music. But I've always been drawn to things like that.
Well, it's interesting. Having done a few of these now, a lot of times people pick songs and it just seems like, you know, where did that come from? And then a few times people have picked songs. It's like, oh yeah, I totally hear that and what you're doing now or what you did 10 years ago. And listening to this again just now, I was like, oh yeah, I can totally hear pieces of this, elements of this, and the stuff you do with Beauty Pill is sort of setting a scene. The lyrics are literary, not just there to sound good. And the melody is kind of takes some unexpected turns.
Thank you for that. I feel like I don't, you know, I definitely don't. I mean, I, in no way do I consider myself in any way, like a peer or parallel with Paul Simon. But that's very kind of you. I mean, I actually didn't even realize, I was thinking that, you know, coming over here, I was thinking, well, what am I going to talk about? And I was really thinking about the words, and how it seems sort of like dryly reporting a sad tale. And then how the emotion sort of sweeps up in the middle of the song, and you really feel all of the anguish, I guess. And so I was actually really mainly focused on the words, And only really in talking about it, like, I guess there are some musical aspects of it that I feel like made an imprint on me. Yeah, and the unexpected melody. I do like the unexpected melody. I'm sorry. Like, I don't know. It's something that appeals to me. The note that you didn't expect, but that is gratifying when you do hear it, is the thing that's my drug. And there's plenty of those notes in Night Game.
This is one of my personal hobby horses about the past, 30 years of rock music, pop music, where, again, words are not necessarily something that you're supposed to pay that close attention to. It's supposed to sound good, supposed to kind of convey something that's maybe not that specific for whatever reason. One of the things that I find interesting about Beauty Pill is that, all those words are there and you're supposed to pay attention to them. They're not just so you have something to sing when you're standing up there.
That's also very kind of you to note. I'm actually trying, the older I get, the more interested I am in making music that people could throw on just because it fills the room with a feeling. That's what I would love to do. But it's true, the words, there's a lot of thought put into the words, and they're often written at night at a time when my brain is raw and or sort of the words are honest. They're from a real place, and yes, there's work put into shaping them. And I do. I'm happy. Beauty Pill gets a lot of, for being a band as relatively obscure as we are, we get a lot of email about the words in the songs. Like, the people write us from all around the world. There's one guy, a guy in England who got married to an African man, and tells me all these really amazing little anecdotes about his life, and how he relates the struggles that they're having as a couple to Beauty Pill songs. And I feel like that's not the typical fan mail that bands get. I feel like there's in a way for me, in the last few years, it's definitely been a more of an increasing feeling of like, hey, people are getting this. People are connecting to it. And that's very gratifying. On the winter frost,
the second song Clark chose as being crucial to his development as an artist was the Branford Marcellus Quartet's Doctone.
Song is Branford Marcellus's, the Branford Marcellus Quartet's Doctone, which came out in 98, 99, I think. Is from an absolutely brilliant record called Requiem, that has a very unfortunate background. Which is that it's the last record that Kenny Kirkland, who is the pianist for the quartet, made before he died. And So the title of the record refers to that morning for him. He died, I think, of a cocaine overdose. I think he had a really, really rough drug problem, and it just took him under. He's a brilliant musician, which you can hear on that recording. He has this very vibrant... His chords have this vibrance and this intelligence and this energy, a glow, I guess, that I really respect and loved, and was very sad when he died. But the circumstance of the record is interesting because it is the Branford Marsalis Quartet with Kenny Kirkland on a record that is dedicated to Kenny and is titled after Kenny. But they made it, they had made it, they had finished a record, which is the record that we're hearing, and then they decided it wasn't quite good enough. They felt like they needed to go back and re-record it. They wanted to go out and play live shows and get more limber as a band, and go into more, you know, richer areas of harmonic and rhythmic interplay, which is what that band is amazing at. And they went out on a tour to kind of basically improve. They had made a record. Jazz records are usually done relatively, take less time than rock records, for sure. Sometimes they're just done in a few days. They went out and to improve on that. And because Kenny died before they were ever able to re-record it, they released the takes that they thought were strong enough to release, and they call it Requiem. To me, when I heard it, I knew when it came out, I knew that he was gone, and I knew it was heartbreaking. He died young, and he is just such a cool musician, such a cool dude. So I went into it kind of with the title Requiem, and if you look at the cover of the Branford Marsalis Requiem album, it's dark blue. There's a real sense of it's austere and it's a gloomy title, and it's a gloomy looking record, and then you hear Doctone, which is named after, which apparently was Kenny's nickname in the band, and there's no darkness in it at all. It's pure euphoria. It's just pleasure and confidence and happiness and exaltation. It's so dope to me that they open this record, which circumstantially had such a Paul, I don't know what the word is, hanging over it. And the very first statement from that record, because it's the first tune that comes out, is just so full of life and so positive and so optimistic. And I feel like there's a real heaviness to that euphoria, because you know, as a listener, what you're listening to. But it was very instructive to me that there's a lot of different ways to get at, to express, to communicate emotion. This is very counterintuitive. All you have to do is hear a few notes of this thing and note that the music just feels completely ecstatic. And I love that. I love that it's not, I mean, they could have released music, or they could have front-loaded the album with music that sounded mournful or sounded melancholic or grim, they were capable of that, but they didn't do that. And it's a band that I really love and really respect. They replaced Kenny Kirkland with what I believe is his protege. I might be getting that wrong. A white guy named Joey Calderazzo, or Calderazzo. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. And they kept rolling, and the piano work just continued to be brilliant. It had a different character because it's a different person. But the band has shifted a few times. They changed drummers once. They had such an amazing, identifiable drummer, Jeff Tane Watts, and they replaced him with a kid whose name is, I think his name is Justin Faulkner. He's like 18, 19 years old, and he's just a brilliant kid. Anyway, I like how this band survives. I like how the Brentford Marsalis Quartet survives and shifts, but never seems to die. And that's really cool to me.
It's interesting because it seems like the timing, this probably would have come out around the time that maybe Smart Went Crazy had broken up or tailed off or whatever happened. Sort of how did this hit you at the time? Were you looking for new things to do? Were you sort of sick of it?
I mean, I don't want to exaggerate the impact of this particular song, but I will say I definitely think it's instructive for me in Beauty Pill I'll take the record that we put out, the last record we put out, which is called Beauty Pill Describes Things as They Are. And that album, I don't think sounds morose. I don't feel like it has it has definitely moments of darkness or whatever, but I feel like it's a record that has a real life to it and real, it's kinetic and it's alive. And again, it's weird for me to cast myself as a peer to Paul Simon or to Brentford Marsalis, but I feel like that it has had an effect on the music that I've done after Smart Went Crazy, for sure.
When Smart Went Crazy broke up, did you already know that you wanted to do something else? I mean, what was sort of your... Was Beauty Pill already there and sort of a formative germ, or did it take a while?
Smart Went Crazy was a really good band that I always knew was a very good band. I know that sounds so arrogant. I don't mean to sound arrogant. It was a band that I knew. Like, breaking that band up was not because the band sucked. It was a strong band with a lot of electricity and a lot of power. We could have kept making great music if we were willing to endure the misery of what that would mean for us at a personal level. So we were an unhappy band, probably for kind of typical reasons at that stage. I don't think there's anything about Smart Went Crazy's breakup that is particularly... I feel like a lot of cliches of like artistic differences and so-and-so doesn't get along with so-and-so and doing this kind of thing. So no, I didn't really have a plan. I knew that I wanted to continue making music. The sequence for me was we made Con Art, the last Smart Went Crazy record, which I loved. I was really proud of. And I also felt like it was the end of that band. And then I went to the studio to work on the Dismemberment Plan, Emergency and I record, where there was a lot of money a large budget, larger budget than I'd ever encountered in my working life in the studio. And I took some of the money that I made from that and bought enough gear to make a mobile record with with Beauty Pill. And I had just decided I really wanted to explore the kind of the some of the aspects of Smart and Crazy that I really felt had more terrain to yield. And that was the initial idea behind Beauty Pill. And we wanted to make pop music. We wanted to do something simpler than Smart and Crazy, because Smart and Crazy got sometimes pretty dense and complicated. We wanted to make something simpler and more efficacious and leaner, and not quite as heavy. Smart and Crazy was loaded with a lot of personal personal feeling and personal anguish that went into that music. And Beauty Pill's initial idea was to kind of like, there's not going to be any autobiographical songs, or like, because there's Smart and Crazy, there's a lot of there are a lot of songs that are real like threadbare allegories for my own life, and I didn't, you know, I wanted to get away from that with Beauty Pill. Our initial kind of personality model was closer to like Stereolab. I know we didn't get anywhere close to that, because whenever I tell people that, everybody's like, really? But yeah, I kind of wanted to, I liked the wryness of Stereolab. I liked the, and I felt like the emotion, you know, that's a band where there's almost this sort of, I mean, they're playing off of it to some extent with their communist, sort of socialist ideas, but there's almost a sort of, it seems music without, that just seems like an expression of a group of people in a room. I mean, the name Stereolab is pretty accurate, you know. So we were kind of, that was more what we were trying to do with the Beauty Pill. Nobody got it, and clearly we failed.
Clark's third and final choice was Jay-Z's 2017 track, The Story of O.J. Please note that while there is potentially offensive language contained therein, it is essential to the intention of the song and is being left in for that reason.
Rich nigga, poor nigga, house nigga, feel nigga, still nigga, still nigga. I like that second one. Light nigga, dark nigga, faux nigga, real nigga, rich nigga, poor nigga, house nigga, feel nigga, still nigga.
The first song I brought in to talk about was from 76. Next thing is from 99, and that song I think came out last year, and is life changing for me, even though I'm in my 40s. You know, I initially thought about formative, you know, the premise of your show being that you looking for sort of formative, seminal songs that for your whole approach to life. But one of them for me hit me pretty late, just last year. First of all, I love that my pulse went up immediately with that song. I value the physiological response to music. Maybe, you know, like you were saying earlier, like the words for Beauty Pill are important, and that's true. But I really just want a feeling. Feelings come from many different... There's lots of different ways to generate feeling. And that song immediately has a menace to it and an ache that I just loved. And it brings in Nina Simone, and it chops up Nina Simone, which is kind of vulgar and wrong. I mean, you cannot be messing with Nina Simone. And he does, and it's kind of offensive, and it's kind of wrong. And I love all of the ways in which that song is wrong. I like some spice of wrong in music. That's exciting to me. That's electric to me. And I'll get into my own interpretation of or response to the content of the lyrics. But I really want to emphasize that the main thing about that piece of music is that you feel it in your stomach as soon as it starts. And then, you know, as soon as his words come in, it just takes it to another level. I know that takes it to another level is such a cliche, but, you know, I mean, that's what happens. Okay, here is the mind. I mean, Jay-Z, I'm not even a dedicated fan. Like, I think he's all right. I think he's smart, has done some cool shit. Some of his stuff I like, some of it I don't like. I'm not an intense fan. But to me, this song, and I feel like he knew it, he's just vibrating with a very special kind of genius. Okay, first thing is the song is called The Story of OJ. So that title, as soon as that music, that sort of sinister music comes in, and you've got that title, we all know that the story of OJ is incredibly violent and incredibly horrific, but that's not what this song is about at all. He just uses that little flash of horror that's in your brain when you put the word story of OJ and what you're about to listen to. He just uses it he dangles it as like a thing in the corner. Just, it's not even the main thing that he's trying to bring up. He brings up this quote from O.J. Simpson, which I remember. I don't know if it's an exact quote, but O.J. Simpson had this idea that he was such a star and such an amazing person that he transcended race, like that race didn't really apply to him. Or he, you know, there's that line, I'm not black, I'm OJ. And if you listen to the song again, check out the pause between I'm not black, I'm OJ, and then he just pauses and he's like, okay. And exactly that phrasing, exactly the way it sounds bemused, but also kind of, I mean, there's so much level, there's so much rich communication in every second in this song. The fact that he drops and he leaves the beat hanging for that long before he says, okay, And it rhymes. It completes the rhyme, but it's you're not you don't and you and it's at that moment it's Jay-Z talking to OJ. Like it's very trippy and beautiful in my opinion. Very inspired, and to me that's enough. Like like just the opening of that song is just so great. And there's actually and in the very beginning of the song, you hear him talking to the engineer and the recording engineer in the session, and giving him instructions. And it's real. I don't think it's canned or performed. I think that is actually just Jay-Z talking to his engineer, and they kept it in. So there's a reality of Jay-Z's reality that we're going into, and they want you to know this is Jay-Z speaking from Jay-Z's point of view. And that is the thing about this song. It's Jay-Z's point of view. Nobody has Jay-Z's point of view. I mean, think about Jay-Z's life. There's no, like, he's got to know. There's no way he's going to be able to be a relatable figure at this point. He's got to let that go. Because he's living some kind of bizarre royalty. I mean, he's using in the song, he's using his actual life. He's using his actual, experience and knowledge, and there's a humility to it. And part of the song is him talking about, he's giving instructions. It's actually like economic instructions. He's just disseminating, you know, here's what I've learned being this fucking rich. Excuse my language again. I apologize. Here's what I've learned being this rich. Here's what I've learned, you know, from my vantage. And I want to pass it on to you because I think it's valuable knowledge. I think I have something of value to give you. You, the listener. And even at one point, he even talks back to the listener. He says, like, I know you think it's bougie, but I'm trying to give you some game. And it's just an amazing line. He's just like, look, you gave me some money for this album. I want to give you something you can actually take out into the world, into the marketplace, and use. And essentially what he's arguing for, which is so radical in as a hip hop message, is fiscal prudence. That song is about fiscal prudence. That song is about not going into debt. That song is about staying above, you know, staying in the black or whatever. And at one point, there's this sort of, you could view it as anti-Semitic reference, where he says all the Jews in America, essentially he's giving them, he's saying it's a culture that I admire, but it's debatable. It's certainly debatable that could be viewed as an anti-Semitic line. So, you know, that sucks, but it's very real and very raw. And his message of liberation is, you know, keep your money together, you know, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. Understand that money is power. And I think that is not a, that's not a tip, you know, that's not a message you're going to hear from Chuck D. You know what I mean? Like, that's a message that you're not going to hear from. I mean, I'm a huge Mos Def fan. I'm a huge fan of a lot of progressive rap. But it's pretty rare that you get the kind of capitalist assertion you hear in this song. And I'm someone who, like politically identifies as much more of a left person. But there's no question that... when you get money in the hands of minorities and the money in the hands of women, money in the hands of marginalized people, that's good for the world. And that's exactly what, you know, the Trump administration is afraid of. That's exactly what mainstream, you know, Indiana Republican America is afraid of. That's exactly the kind of power they fear. And he's saying, build your power. Understand where what power is. And this is a form of power. And so I see it as an entirely, a very provocative and kind of acerbic, you know, way of putting it. But it's essentially an enlightening, his intent is enlightenment. I love that song.
One of the many interesting things about Jay-Z is that no MC has ever been where he is. You know, he's worth almost $1 billion, I think.
I mean, yeah, who can, I mean, exactly.
Right. But, you know, it's also, you know, you bring up the fact that you're in your 40s. I mean, he is too. And he's still at it in a game that is often thought of as being like, you know, a young man's game, a young person's game. You know, your first couple, three albums or mixtapes or whatever come out and everybody's on to you. And then after a while, you just fall off. People get interested in something else.
Exactly. Let me address that and just say that I actually hadn't thought of Jay-Z's age in the context of this, but that's true, what you just said. And I really love... I always have loved adult work. I think some of Fugazi's strongest work happens towards the end of their discography. Like, I think they kept getting richer and more and bolder and more exciting and more dangerous. I don't associate getting older as a sort of one-to-one relationship with getting lamer. You know what I mean? So I don't have a problem getting older. It's not something that freaks me out. Some of my heroes, like one of them is Ardo Lindsay, who my band went on tour with a couple times last year, and it was like one of the best experiences of my life. Ardo's in his 60s, and he's still a badass. He's more of a badass because he marshals all of the knowledge and the wisdom and the experiences that he had before, and he brings them onto the stage and everything that he does. That's not something you can do unless you're a 62-year-old Brazilian genius, you know. For a while, my studio was next to what my music studio was next door to Sam Gilliam, the painter, who I think is in his 80s now. He was a total inspiration for me. Just being near him, seeing a black man who just followed his vision and made it work, and made a living out of it. Sam was making a very good living out of it. What I'm trying to say is a lot of my heroes are people who are much older than me, and I want to be where they are. I mean, that's, you know, I looked at Art Lindsay with envy. I felt like a student. And seeing like a master at work, definitely inspiring and intimidating in equal measure. So I don't associate, and youth, a lot of times, like when sometimes I'll check out like whatever band is playing on late night TV or whatever. It's a band of 20-somethings, and they're doing something that I have seen before. They're doing something, and they're doing it in a very rote, kind of orthodox way. I mean, the bands that crib from the Stones and the Velvets and the Stooges bore the shit out of me. because I have those records. I don't need more of them. And so yeah, I don't have any. There's nothing like being a middle-aged artist. Being a middle-aged badass is to me like that's par for the course.
Y'all think it's bougie, I'm like, it's fine, but I'm trying to give you $1 million worth of game for $9.99. I turn a 2 to a 4, 4 to a 8. I turn my life into a nice first week release date. Y'all is still taking advances, huh? Me and my niggas taking real chances, y'all on the gram holding money to your ear. There's a disconnect, we don't pull that money over here, yeah.
This has been Essential Tremors. Essential Tremors is produced by me, Matt Byers, and Lee Gardner. Essential Tremors is distributed by WYPR Baltimore and NPR. Look for and subscribe to all of WYPR's podcasts at wypr.org/podcastcentral. For more information about Essential Tremors, go to essentialpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.